Hey everyone, it's Kevin. Before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder that it is greatly appreciated if you help support the show by going to thefitcast.com and clicking on the donations tab. Your support is going to be helping to keep the show going strong as we get past episode 300 and continue to go forward. Please, if you've enjoyed the show for these last couple years and you're in the position to do so, go to thefitcast.com, click on that donation tab, and help support us going forward. Thanks. Hello, welcome back to the FitCast. This is episode number 298. I am Kevin Larrabee, and I'm very happy to have back on the show one of the originals, Lou Schuler. What's up, Lou?
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
I'm doing great, and I feel like this is just going full circle because on the, you know, when I originally started the show, like, I think it was episode 13 was the first one that you were on, and, you know, we also got to meet, like, when the genesis of this started at the JP Fitness Summit back in 2006. Long time ago.
that was a really long time ago. And I'll say this about myself, which, you know, I hope everyone listening, you know, anything I say following this is, you know, so they can take all that with a grain of salt. When you told me that you were starting a podcast where you're going to talk about fitness, I thought, who in the world would listen to a podcast about fitness?
I know.
So there's an example of something I was totally wrong about.
Well, you know, it worked out all right. And to correct myself, it was actually episode 7. And this was back in the day when I was doing the show with John Williams, who was out in Colorado and working with John Berardi on some cool stuff with gourmet nutrition and things like that. And, you know, since then, he's had a couple kids and, you know, I don't even know. I got to reconnect with him because I haven't even checked in with him in a long time. But, yeah, it's been kind of weird. It just happens, you know, you just keep going.
Yeah, John's a great guy, and I had totally forgotten that you started it with him. I saw him a couple of years ago. We did an article on the paleo diet for Men's Health,
and that's right.
John and I later wrote an article for menshealth.com, and then he wrote one for my website. So I've gotten to work with John a couple times. You know, he's definitely in his field, but he's still interested in all the stuff we do.
So let's get into it because we actually got a lot of questions for you. A lot of people sent stuff in for the interview. And, you know, for me personally, I would just like to start off and ask you, you know, what you've been up to, because the last time that we did talk, it was yourself and that Alan Cosgrove guy. I don't know what he's doing, but he's probably still running a gym or something. But
dropped off the face of the earth.
Yeah, I don't know. But wait, what have you been up to? Obviously, you're still doing lots of Reinig and you've got some projects going on.
Yes, still doing a lot. I'm very happy to say that, you know, the industry still keeps me busy. I write for menshealth.com, which is probably the easiest place to kind of catch up on what I've been doing. Also for Men's Health magazine, not as frequently. And then the books keep me going. The next book I wrote is called The Lean Muscle Diet. Wrote that with Alan Aragon, and it's the first time I've attempted to do a real weight loss book since Testosterone Advantage Plan, which was the first book with my name on it. That came out in 2002. So the book with Alan Aragon comes out December 23rd of this year. Like I said, it's called The Lean Muscle Diet, and it's targeted to men. But again, it's sort of like the original New Rules of Lifting. There's nothing in there that women can't use. Mm-hmm. But it was just, you know, Rodale wanted to do it as a book targeted to men. And then Alan Cosgrove and I, the mysterious Alan Cosgrove, who nobody's seen in ages, the two of us are writing a new book called Strong, and it's another strength training book for women. It's very much a follow-up to the New Rules of Lifting for Women, which is by far our most popular title. And we're in the process of writing that now. So the current release date is fall 2015, which you know, sounds like a long time away, but in publishing terms, that's just right around the corner. So pretty close to time to start panicking about that, even though I'm months away from the deadline. It's never too early to panic.
Well, I'm interested just because when you mentioned, you know, when you have like a book project, is it a little difficult to just, you know, make it a general book? Is it just a lot better for, in terms of, you know, getting the book out there to target a specific population, whether it be males or females?
Oh, sure. You know, one of the oldest cliches in journalism or in any type of writing, I guess, is if you write for everybody, you're writing for nobody. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that with a lot of people who try to get into writing, no matter what, you know, whether it's fitness or anything else. If it looks like it's just sort of disconnected and they're just sort of speaking, you know, and I think a lot of official organizations will do this. Like if you go to, say, the like a medical organization's website, you'll see a lot of this kind of speaking from the heavens, which is here's a proclamation for everybody. Mm-hmm. But the entire fitness industry is based on targeting, is getting into specific problems that specific people actually have. So the more targeted I am at the start of a project, the better the project will be. That is, if I think of one, sometimes it's a matter of me thinking of one specific person and saying, I'm going to write the book that specific person needs, and it's going to address that specific person's interests. It's going to answer that person's questions. It's going to give that person a lot more than they thought they needed. But that's because that person doesn't have the knowledge that my co-authors and I have. So we're going to tell them a lot of stuff they haven't even thought to ask about. But the main thing we're going to do is we're going to address the problem they have, the concern they have, with the goal of helping them achieve the benefit they want. And all these things, the more specific they are, the better and more successful that book's going to be. Hmm. Of course, if you start off with somebody and say, okay, this person weighs 127 pounds, he's 6'2", and I'm going to write a book for that person who clearly has a tapeworm and help that person gain weight. Well, that's probably not going to be a very successful book because there's only a handful of people who can identify with that specific problem. So, you know, when you pick that target, you probably want that person to be representative of a lot of other people out there, specifically people who buy books. Any of us could write a book targeted to, say, you know, teenage male lifters. And anybody who's ever been in a gym where teenage male lifters are working out knows how much help those guys need. Problem is, nobody knows how to get them to pay attention to or buy books. So you can't write books targeting them, even though they need more help than just about anybody else out there, because they won't buy books. I mean, I know they buy something, but nobody knows how to, you know, how to market to them. At least nobody in the publishing industry. So that's a long way of saying that whoever you're targeting needs to be somebody who actually would be interested in buying your product.
Yeah, it's always been fascinating just the idea of like targeting material for a population and how difficult that must be, and, you know, the mistakes that have been made and, you know, figuring out what works, because that's what one of the things I would like to talk to you about in a little bit is like the state of the fitness industry and like the way things are marketed to people these days and whether it's how they're being targeted and things like that. But we're going to pause on that for a second, because another nobody sent in a question. This guy, Jonathan Fass, I think he's a doctor. He said,
What kind of doctor is he? That sounds really suspicious to me.
I think he's a veterinarian.
Oh, really? Okay. All right. Well, I have a lot of respect for veterinarians.
I could never do it.
Yeah. Anybody who has to, you know, dig through dog poop, you know, to make a diagnosis, that they get my respect.
I would just be in tears every time I had to treat a sick animal. I'm such a weak person that way. But he says, is there anything that Lou would change about his career? If he was barred from writing ever again, what would he be doing? If he had to do it all over again, would he?
Well, I have no idea what I would do if I weren't writing, because once I got it in my head that I was a writer. Nothing else ever got into my head to replace that. So I think it, you know, if I hadn't found this particular path, that's an interesting question. And I honestly have no idea. And it goes to show how much luck has to do with anything, even modest success like mine. And I know I've told this story a bunch of times, but just in case nobody's heard it, I was this skinny kid. I was slow. I was terrible at sports, but I loved sports, wanted to play, started working out when I was like 13, been working out ever since. And I'm 57 now as we speak. I had just a conventional journalism, went to journalism school in the late 70s, had a conventional journalism career, went out to Los Angeles to write, you know, screenplays and novels and stuff, and ended up waiting tables. But basically, I've always written every day for as long as pretty much as long as I can remember. That was always, you know, I was at the, you know, I was scribbling in a pad, or I was typing, or I was, you know, on a word processor. Or, you know, whatever we have in the future, I'm sure I'll be working on that, because I, you know, once I started writing, I couldn't stop. But what people were willing to pay me to write has changed quite a bit over the years. And it wasn't until I was in my early 30s and I had gone, I was at the University of Southern California in the graduate creative writing program there, you know, desperate for work. And there was this, you know, it was a early 90s, there was a recession in Los Angeles. I couldn't get a job waiting tables or tending bar. Answered an ad in the LA Times for a fitness journalist. And that's how I ended up at Men's Fitness. Started working there. Actually, I started as a part-time copy editor at Muscle and Fitness, and I wrote freelance articles for that magazine and for Men's Fitness. I've been, you know, started full-time at Men's Fitness in 92. Moved across the country, started working at Men's Health in 98, left there in 2004 to go freelance. But basically I've been doing, you know, now we're 22 years of me writing about fitness, and it was absolute pure luck that I got into it to begin with. When I was in journalism school, there was, you know, fitness journalism didn't exist. Fitness back then was running, and, you know, God knows I was not cut out to be a runner. So I had no idea that anybody got paid to write about this. And I've often said, I hope not on your show because then I'm repeating a line, but, you know, the biggest mistake I made as a fitness journalist was making it look like it was fun. Because of the time I got into it, the people who were conventionally trained, like I was, you know, who had a journalism education and come up through newspapers and magazines, none of those people wanted to write about fitness. And if they got stuck writing about fitness for a while, it was something they couldn't wait to get out of. I was the first person who got into it and said, you know, okay, I can do this for a while. This is really, you know, it matches up my life interest with, the skills and whatever talent I brought to the table. But it was certainly something that once I got into it, I didn't want to get out of it, which was really unique. And now I hear from people all the time who say, yeah, I want to do exactly what you do. Which I guess, like I said, is, you know, my mistake for making it look like it was fun.
How dare you?
Well, I'm flattered, but it gets to, and you notice I'm ignoring John's question entirely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would too.
Yeah. I mean, it's John Fass. I mean, that just sounds dodgy. But somebody else asked a question like, I think that it was something to do with mentors. Do you remember what the specific question was?
Yeah, I'll put up right now. This is from Devin. If you were to start over, what question would you ask your mentors?
Well, see, now that there is an impossible question to answer, because, like I said, when I started, there was nobody else who was doing what I did. I mean, obviously, I went to magazine. You know, I went to a magazine, and it was full of people who were writing and editing articles about fitness, nutrition, health. Mm-hmm. But going back to journalism school, there was, you know, nobody I could talk to about this. Nobody had any concept that fitness magazines would one day be a really viable, successful niche within publishing. And I had no mentors. I had nobody who could give me any advice about how to move along a career track. I don't know if that's good or bad. I just feel like I've been making it up all along. And now when people ask me questions, I kind of like try to it's like I try to think backwards, like what can I say to that person that would help them avoid some of the mistakes that I made when I was in that person's position? And the honest answer is, you know, I really can't help anybody. I can tell them what mistakes I made, but some of them were unique to circumstances I was in or unique to the times that don't exist anymore. Certainly a lot of the younger people now understand marketing, online networks much better than I did, because those things didn't exist when I started. So I guess one really key piece of advice that I try to get out there, and I'm not sure anybody ever listens to me, but you know, that's okay. I feel better just having said it, is at a certain point, the market tells you what it needs. And if you're a successful trainer and you're writing a blog and you're putting interesting ideas out there, the fitness market will find you. They'll, you know, if you're writing for web, you know, if your work is getting attention, if you have ideas that are interesting, eventually you'll probably make your way to the big, you know, web magazines like T-Nation. And once you're there, then the print magazines are going to pay attention because everybody reads that. And no matter how busy you are, no matter what your background is, if you have those interesting ideas, the publishing industry, the fitness publishing industry, will find you. The problem is when you don't have those interesting ideas and you're way on the outside and nobody's ever said, dude, man, you should totally be in T-Nation, or you should be in Men's Health, or you should be in Men's Fitness, or you should share that with Muscle and Fitness. If nobody's saying that to you, and yet anyway you decide I should be in those publications, that's a really hard slog. And I don't know how to help people. I get that question, and I honestly don't know how to answer it in a way that is any way helpful. You know, I tell people, you got to keep working. Mm-hmm. Don't act like you're an acknowledged expert if that's not what anybody acknowledges that you are yet. You know, there's a long way to go from you're a trainer, you're in great shape, and you've got a couple of clients who are successful, to somebody who is perceived as being an expert, an authority, much less a guru, much less somebody who should be in all these outlets like T-Nation or Men's Health. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many steps in between there, the most important of which I would say is demand. If there's nobody demanding your opinion, if you're not filling a gap in the marketplace, you know, where somebody goes, that's exactly what I need and I haven't seen it yet, then you're probably not ready to make those steps. And this is even, you know, harsher, you may not ever be ready. But if you just keep working and keep writing and keep training clients and keep up with your education, you may find an entirely different niche where there is demand, where people do want you, where people are crying out for somebody just like you. You didn't know it was there. At some point, due to luck, you're going to stumble into that. But you'll be prepared when you get there, because you will have done all these other things. You will have tried things where nobody wanted you. And I'll say that I say all this from experience, because when I was in journalism school, I thought I was going to be a movie critic and a columnist, and I'd be the funny guy. I'd be the Dave Barry guy, you know, or the Mike Royko guy or something like that. I thought that's what I would be coming out of journalism school. And what's you know, of course, now we can look back at that and go, who are those people? Because nobody reads newspapers anymore, at least not in print. So the whole newspaper industry doesn't even exist. The industry that I trained for back in journalism school does not even exist anymore. So not only did I not reach my – I did reach my goals, but in a very mediocre way, small publications that nobody was paying attention to at the time. But I figured out that there was no demand within the marketplace for me to do those things. And eventually there was no marketplace where anybody wanted anybody to do those things. You know, it had all moved online where I had no traction at all. And of course, then I've tried to write, you know, screenplays, novels. I did self-publish my novel called Saints Alive, available on Amazon.com a few months ago. And once again, if nobody's demanding your work, boy, it is really hard to get that out there without just repeatedly going to your friends and annoying the shit out of them. So I am simultaneously really well experienced, or deeply experienced in one thing, but in all these other things that I've tried or that I will try in the future, I have no more experience and no more chance of success than anybody out there who's listening to this. So at the same time, I'm in the boat with them. Even though when it comes to fitness writing, you know, I'm lucky enough to have steady work there. And I think I'm not sure exactly what the lesson is, except that if you keep working and keep your eyes open, eventually, if you're good at something, the marketplace will let you know what that thing is. It's not that you're entirely passive. You're working hard the whole time, but at some point you're going to see a direction to focus that work that probably would have been invisible to you 5 years before or 10 years before. So that's my uplifting message, is with hard work, good things will happen.
Well, let me ask you, just because, you know, after doing the podcast for 8 years and being in the industry for a while, I've seen a lot, and I get a lot of, you know, emails, like maybe one or two a week, saying like, oh, you know, I have this new book out, or I have this new ebook or something like that. You know, I have all these qualifications. Can I come on the show and, you know, basically, you know, sell my stuff? But I've grown a little bit cynical when it comes to trends and stuff on the fitness industry. I try to avoid Facebook as much as possible. And I was just kind of curious, like what do you feel about the current state of things? Because there's definitely like our certain, like the group that kind of we are in with, like the, whether it's like the Men's Health and the T Nation, like it's almost like the same kind of group of people that we all read and listen to. What are your thoughts on the current state of things? And I'm going to direct this specifically with a question from Roland, someone that we've known forever. How has the internet made learning about fitness better and worse? Because I think it's definitely better, but for me personally, it's sometimes it gets a little tough to constantly be getting, you know, marketing emails. And even me personally, I try not to do it so much with the Fitcast. I just try to like tell people about stuff from people that I really trust and I really value.
Well, it can either be a simple or complex question. One, when you talk about the circles, you know, of people who have been in this for a few years, I find a trend that I think I wish it weren't as much of a trend, of people arguing about what doesn't work. And when that's your message, this doesn't work, that doesn't work, this doesn't work, you aren't helping people. And you especially aren't helping the people who have done that and had success with it, because they say, well, but if I've had success with it, it must work. Now, the person who's making the argument that it doesn't work maybe saying, well, something else would work better, or the theoretical basis of this, the marketing materials are inaccurate, the theoretical reason it would work isn't well supported, that's all fine. But that could be the one program that this person enjoyed and this person therefore put a really high level of effort into. And that's why the person had success. So to tell the person this program doesn't work or that there are better programs out there, it's not helping anybody. So I guess especially when you talk about the marketing, mm-hmm. I have seen an influx of people who don't seem to have much interest in helping people, and that's really disturbing to me, because we're in a service industry. You know, we do not our fulfillment, our success depends on helping people, other people achieve their goals. And it has to be specific and it has to be real. There has to be a real biological result from the advice that we give people. And if the reason we exist is to make money off those people, and if the reason they exist in our eyes is to give us money, then I think the whole thing's a failure. Where the internet, the internet obviously offers people a lot of free information, but with any level of discernment or discrimination, you can see how much of that information only exists to sell something. It's basically it looks great, but it's just a marketing pitch to get you into something else. So the information that people are giving away for free that's not tied into marketing another product is only going to be a tiny little sliver of what somebody would need to be successful. It's one piece of a puzzle that might have 5,000 pieces, but it's free. You know, that's all you can afford to give away. I certainly can't afford to give away entire programs. I've got to save that for the book. So when I write something, when I write a post, or when I write an online article that somebody's paying me to write, I'm still only giving somebody a small piece of what they would need. So the problem with the internet is if in one day you can digest hundreds of these small pieces, they're not all pieces of the same puzzle. So you might, over a week, okay, now I've got 250 puzzle pieces. How do I put them together? But there are 250 puzzle pieces that go to 75 different puzzles. So you're never going to get the full picture based on all these small parts. So in that sense, the internet can be extremely distracting, frustrating, sometimes even giving people counterfactual information where that's the wrong word. Information that is inaccurate or unhelpful for their goals, because again, it's a piece of somebody else's puzzle that they're trying to fit into a completely different puzzle. So this guy who's program needs to be like 5,000 puzzle pieces, and he's gone on the internet and he's found 25 of them along with 225 that go to different puzzles. Now, is he better for having the 25 pieces of his puzzle, or is he worse for having hundreds of pieces of puzzles that aren't that go to puzzles that don't help him whatsoever? He may be doing two things that negate each other, or he may be trying to do, in a lot of cases, trying to do too much. Mm-hmm. Or, if the guy just finds five pieces of the puzzle that is him, he might he'll probably end up doing too little and saying, why isn't this working? I'm doing the workouts for fat loss. Why aren't I losing fat? And then if he makes a mistake of putting that question out there on social media, naively thinking that people are actually going to help him, what are they going to say? They're going to just jump down his throat. Oh my God, it's 90% abs are made in the kitchen. Where the hell have you been? Haven't you been on the internet? Don't you know all this internet wisdom that we, the in crowd, have agreed on? And again, now here's one of the bigger problems with the internet, whether we're talking about fitness sites, or it could be sports, or it could be politics, or it could be anything else. Conspiracies, whatever it is, whatever people form a community around, there will always be an in-group, and the in-group knows the latest code words, and they know what everybody else in the in-group is supposed to think. Mm-hmm. So if you come into that from the outside and you don't know what all these code words are, they're just going to jump down your throat and they're going to drive you away. So you've got the in-group, you've got the out-group, who are probably intimidated and trying to figure out how to become a member of the in-group. And then you have the troll group who just go around and try to piss people off. And they're the least helpful people in the entire history of civilization. Internet trolls are just the if there were a vaccine, somebody could make a lot of money off that.
Well, I'm curious. I mean, obviously there's the internet trolls and stuff out there, but I've had this discussion with, a couple people that I'm friends with, and I think I love these people, but they'll spend time on Facebook or whatever, like just calling people out, like, oh, I can't believe so-and-so wrote this again. Like, clearly, like, this makes no sense. It's not backed by research. And, even I've talked to Jonathan Fast, that guy that we don't know, a couple minutes ago, about a lot of the stuff where he's, research-based. You know, if it's not backed by, you know, multiple research studies, if it's not proved in a laboratory, then, you know, it doesn't work. And I'm over-exaggerating and I'm simplifying, you know, that statement. But I don't know if that's healthy for and that's why I stay off Facebook, because I was getting to the point where, like, I'm just getting pissed off reading this stuff just because It's not because they're wrong. It's just because I feel like I'm a guy that likes to stay positive these days. I got, you know, limited amount of free time. If I'm going to be on the internet, I would like it to be relatively positive. So I stay off of, you know, places where the negativity can come from. And there's people in the industry who are overly negative that I avoid, even if they have good information. So it's just like wondering what's your take on that? Is it just, even if it's good information, there's a negative slant to it, or if maybe it's just like, what's the spin that you're going to put on it?
Well, I agree with everything you just said. And I find that incredibly frustrating, especially when it's friends of mine who are putting out that relentless negativity, because like I said, it's not helping people. It's not educating people. It's just getting people to dig in and take sides. And sometimes people take sides, when they otherwise, if you approach it a different way, they might be more open-minded. But as soon as you get people into a defensive mode, and I'm sure you can, I think you actually can back this up with a lot of research, that as soon as you back people into a corner and get them into a defensive mode, you've lost any ability, any opening to persuade that individual.
Sure.
So where I stand on the research-based versus experience-based, I don't think it's a dichotomy at all, because if something works in experience, then there must be some research out there, or there must be at least a theoretical basis for why that works. So we know that when we're talking about fitness and nutrition, there's a handful of bedrock principles. We know that if the goal is to get stronger, there has to be a progressive overload of the muscles. We know that we know that if that progressive overload occurs too quickly, the person's probably going to get hurt. So we want to make sure that this is part of a gradual, stepwise program. Those of us with experience know that nothing's linear. So there's always going to be, there's always going to be plateaus. There's always going to be setbacks. So we can prepare for that and try to come up with the best program. Now, when we finally get to that program will not be something that's ever been proven effective in some sort of randomized, highly controlled study, in an intervention protocol. But everything, every part of it makes sense in that it's backed up by what we know to be true about strength training, the body's metabolism. We know that, we know that there's a benefit to exercise, there's a benefit to physical activity. We don't have to back that up with 100 studies, because those studies have been done, and I don't think any of that's in dispute. Some of the stuff that people argue about, like, well, does a bad posture cause pain? Well, that's interesting. Maybe all these years we've been telling people that if they don't sit up straight, that they're going to end up with back pain. And now we say, well, maybe that's not really based on anything, except that even if we can't figure out exactly what the mechanism is that we can't say, okay, this person has this kind of posture. Do people who have that posture typically have pain, and is pain related to that posture? And then we say, well, pain's not related to that posture. But if there's one person who has that posture and is in pain, it doesn't do them any good at all to say, well, by the way, your posture has nothing to do with your pain. If we're going to help that person, we say, wow, okay, so you're in pain. What can we do? And maybe one of the things we say, let's try to improve your posture. And then, whether we want to get into all the arguments about whether posture can actually be improved or whatever, if we're not helping that person resolve their pain, or if it's somebody who wants to lose weight, if we're not helping that person lose weight, it sort of doesn't matter who's right or wrong in all these internet arguments. The fact is, there's one person out there we haven't helped, which means collectively we have failed that one person. And I wish we could all just keep that in mind. There's somebody out there we haven't helped. Why not?
Yeah, I think it's for me, it's all about, I love the debate. I think it's healthy, but I think it's about keeping it, you know, positive and not having like a negative, like a snarky tone to it. Like, I know more than this person knows, and I'm going to call them out on it. That kind of thing. It's probably why it keeps me from participating in a lot of that stuff. And it is why when I do the show these days, it's almost, it's to get good information out there. But, part of it is just selfishly, I get people on the show that I want to talk to. It's bringing good people to the front of the crowd with, not to sound powerful, but with the power of the podcast. Like, we have over 25,000 regular listeners. So we can get a good amount of, education out there to people that can digest it. But it's interesting to see it, because I was on the forums like with you back in like 06, like whether it was at the JP Fitness or going on like even bodybuilding.com and like seeing like what these forums look like today. It's just, maybe it's something you grow out of after a couple of years, but it's just very interesting to watch and to look at.
Yeah, and what you said about, using the position you're in, I certainly use the position I'm in to talk to people I find interesting and ask them questions that I genuinely don't know the answer to. I can talk to, and that's what I love about the position I'm in, because I can talk to somebody with the goal of getting an article. But at the same time, I'm getting stuff that I'm going to go to the gym that day and use in my own workouts, or I might get a nutrition tip that, I can put into practice the very next time I eat a meal. So there's, that's where I think that's where our personal interests definitely intersect with the interests and needs of our audience, mm-hmm. in a good way, which is, why, going back to something I said probably like 3 hours ago by this point, to a certain extent, there is an element of luck here, mm-hmm. that we're lucky to be in a position where anybody's paying attention to anything we say, or anything we do. And once we have that position, we can certainly use it to our own advantage. But the open question is, if we're used, does it help anybody else? And if the answer to that is yes, we are helping other people, then fine. Why shouldn't we get something, get something for ourselves, make mm-hmm. a living, get a, get information that we can use that makes our lives better. That becomes the circle of life, I guess. At that point, everybody wins.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Just again to reiterate, these are friends of mine that I'm talking about, and I think it's good to have the debate. I think it's more just about, keeping it, positive, and let's just all stay on the same playing field. We don't have to, stand a couple feet higher than the rest of the people we're talking to. But let's continue moving on. We get an interesting question from Joey. How has the consumer mindset been changed over the last few years with their expectations of fitness programs? There's so much more out there that the consumer is seeing regularly, such as Instagram videos and posts along with, CrossFit games and mid runs, etc. Has their perspective shifted as professionals do we approach the consumer differently now?
Wow, that is a great question. The danger that I see with the proliferation of the media that the question cited, Instagram and the CrossFit games, is that we're seeing a steady parade of outliers, and with no perception of how rare these outliers are. For example, if you're going to sell a weight loss book, you're going to find the one outlier and sell the book around that one outlier. This is the guy who lost 87 pounds in 6 weeks, and look at him now. You're not telling the reader that this guy is one in a million of all the people who try to get that same result. He's the only one who actually got that result, and yet you're building an entire program around this one outlier. And that seems to be, for example, do you remember a few months ago there was some woman who had just given birth to, like, I don't know, her fourth or fifth kid or something, and started posting all these pictures of herself being ripped and in great shape. And it's like, I can do it. You're all lazy if you can't do it.
Yeah.
And that provoked a, you know, a media firestorm. When I looked at that, I thought, you know, my first thought was, yeah, good for you. All right. Yeah, great. Yeah, totally. You know, it goes to show that the pregnancy has, you know, pregnancy and childbirth don't destroy everybody. Mm-hmm. They just do a number on like 99% of women's bodies. And she happens to be in the 1% and the 1/10 of 1% who just a few months after giving birth looks, you know, incredible and photo ready and all that. But she is an extreme outlier. And so we have two problems there. One is this extreme outlier thinks that if only everybody else, that other people can will themselves to be outliers, you know, that it has absolutely nothing to do with her genetics or how she had prepared her body before she had babies. And that person will never credit genetics with her success. She'll say, well, I worked hard. Say, yeah, but lots of people work hard, or lots of people can't work as hard as you because they're too banged up. Or they don't have the genetic propensity to get in the sort of, you know, reach a conditioning level you've reached. They certainly don't have a genetic propensity to get into your, you know, to get to your low level of body fat. So here's an outlier who's saying, hey, I'm an outlier through hard work. It has absolutely nothing to do with anything else. And people are looking at this picture, and some people are just getting pissed off. Some people are feeling bad about themselves. And then there's other people out there who think, well, if she can do it, I should be able to do it. And then it's like, so why? But what the big problem is that we're not presenting that person as an outlier. She's not presenting herself as an outlier. So basically, we've got no information that's useful to the person who's not an outlier. We just know that here's one person, it worked for her, and now we're all going to be either celebrating her or pissed off at her. Whatever it is, the success she had absolutely nothing to do with anybody who doesn't have her genetics. So it's not helpful, but it does put out this this sense that everybody should be able to achieve these results that actually only a tiny little fraction of people can achieve. So that's where I think that this all these disparate media sort of contribute to this really unhelpful and possibly harmful idea that if you aren't getting these outlier success levels, there's something wrong with you.
I was just fascinated by, again, it is today where you have a photo that goes viral and then it's on every news station. And since there's a 24-hour news cycle, there's nothing to talk about. So
right. There's no actual news, but there's 24 hours of news.
Yeah. So we need three panelists to talk about it. And then on Facebook, you need, you know, everyone that's in your following to talk about it and stuff like that. And you got to get everyone's opinion on it because, you know, we have all these fitness professionals that are writing and stuff like that, or they're posting videos, or, you know, they're, you know, training a couple people and they need to have their opinion. And maybe that's a prime example of things like, man, I just really don't need to spend time on Facebook ever, except if I need to tell people about stuff that I'm doing, you know, like if I need to tell them about a Fitcast interview that's coming up, or, hey, you know, I got this event coming up at Perform Better, I'll be down there, come say hi, something like that.
Yeah. But then the problem with trying to withdraw from that is that you sort of lose your primacy within your own social circles.
Yeah.
So you have to, all of us have to figure out the way to balance that where I'm online, I'm available, people can see I'm a real guy, I'm sharing information, I'm mm-hmm. sharing funny stuff that happened. So there's like that connection with your circle, but you still have to like force yourself to stay out of all these other arguments, even when people are like tagging you on posts and trying to drag you into the arguments. So it makes it harder and more stressful than it probably needs to be. But, you know, this is why they call it work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
This is how we make our living.
It sometimes just makes me want to scream out to the internet, like, why do you give a crap? Like, why do you care so much to get so worked up about this stuff?
Yeah.
There's so many other things that are much more important in life that you could be spending your time on. Like, hell, go walk your dog. Spend some time doing that. Listen, read a book. Read some Shakespeare. Do something that will be, you know, enhancing of your life instead of just like creating more negative energy in your surroundings and stuff like that. That's why it's just, it is fascinating to me to see how people react to this stuff. And it is very, almost demoralizing to see how people will react to it.
Sure. And I think there's also kind of a pressure to put a lot of information out there in small bits. But again, when we do that, you know, we're giving people tiny pieces of a puzzle. And at a certain point, there's so many, like I said earlier, there's just so many puzzle pieces out there that nobody can figure out how to put them together. So you mentioned earlier, just, you know, get off the internet, read a book. I think it's hard for all of us to get out of the mode of reading, you know, tweets and, you know, or, you know, and if YouTube videos are too long, we got Vine so that we can watch a, you know, a 6-second video instead of that 3-minute video, because, you know, who has 3 minutes to spare? But if you get off the internet, you know, if you go offline altogether and sit down and read a book, you're probably going to end up better off, because you may not know what the argument of the instant is, mm-hmm. but now you have some, if it's a good book, now you have some knowledge, you know, or you've kind of lost yourself in the story of a good novel. And let me mention here that I recently self-published my novel, Saints Alive, which the people who have read it and enjoyed quite a bit, either that or they're all lying to me. So let me just throw that out there.
For sure.
that's a commercial portion of our podcast.
And we're back.
But self-interest aside,
yeah,
sitting down and reading a good book with a good narrative, you're going to get so much more out of that than you will from spending an equivalent amount of time jumping around from post to post and tweet to tweet, mm-hmm. and you know, website to website, where you're getting all these, you know, these tiny little pinpricks of information, when here's, you know, you can get this whole download of information that this writer has spent years putting into this book, that will probably make you feel better about yourself and about the world versus all the time you spend getting stressed out over this stuff.
Yeah, totally. And for me, it's been more of even, you don't even have to say like read a book, like for podcasts and stuff like that, being able to, I'm new to This American Life and being able to go back and hear those awesome, like long form pieces of audio, just fascinating stories and things like that, where it is just something that you get a lot out of, and you hear, like, I've listened to some of these stories and been like in tears because, yeah, like how the amazing stories. And I'm always super jealous of the amount of production and time that they can put into those pieces. But, like, that is just a recommendation. If you aren't getting that podcast, it's free, and you can check out the episodes online for free. Definitely give it a look.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I can't remember the last time where I was in a car and I got to listen to an entire episode. But going back a few years, remembering, you know, some of the great stuff, and what they did was, you know, they decided that, you know, they were going to use all the techniques of investigative journalism, mm-hmm. For the little stories, you know, for the little human stories. They're not going to talk to famous people. They're not going to talk to people whose decisions move markets or tilt the balance of power among the great nations. They were going to talk to people who are living lives like ours, yeah. But they were going to employ all the techniques that they'd learned through investigative journalism to sort of dig deeper into these deeply human, you know, in these profound human stories. So, you know, great recommendation.
Let's move forward and talk a little bit more about what you do in terms of, you know, preparing for a title for a new book. Isabel had a question about research. What are your first 2 to 3 sources that you look at when researching a new topic on fitness?
Wow. Well, right. I saw that question and I was hoping we'd get around to that, but I completely forgot about it while I was babbling about puzzle pieces and you know, and whether or not John Fass is somebody we should pay attention to.
Probably not.
Yeah. So what I do, hopefully I'm not, I hope I'm not investigating something brand new cold where I have no idea where to even start, because that's hard to do. When it's something that the way that I keep up with things in general, I get Alan Aragon's research review, and that I feel gives me a great overview of what the current controversies in diet and nutrition areas are. I also get the strength and conditioning research by Brett Contreras, and Chris, his name just popped into my head and then slipped right out. I apologize to Chris. He and Brett do a fantastic idea. You can go to brettcontreras.com and you can get a link to it. But it's strength conditioning research, and they round up every month. They give you an overview of, I think more than 50 studies every month. So you get an idea of what, you know, and this is real nitty gritty stuff, what's brand new out there. So those two sources keep me informed of where the research is going and what people are talking about and what the controversies are. If I'm looking for something brand new, if I just feel like I need information today, I'll go to Twitter and I'll look at the Twitter feeds of either Stuart Phillips, the researcher Stu Phillips, or Stéphane Jeunet, who is his website is wholehealthsource.net. Is that what it's called? His let's see, it's Stéphane, and then his last name is Jeunet, Jeunet. Mm-hmm. He has, if you just look at his Twitter feed, he has the most interesting up-to-date nutrition research as it's breaking. Not that any of us need to know all the research that's breaking, but it's just stuff that I had no idea anybody was even thinking about. You know, I'll find that somebody's done a study and, you know, maybe it has fascinating results, maybe it doesn't. But that's where I find this stuff that's absolutely up to the minute. How I keep up with how I keep up with things. And then if there's something specific, I've gotten an assignment for Men's Health, or I'm at a chapter in the book where I need information I don't yet have, and I don't have it from those sources that I just mentioned, then I'll go to then I'll certainly go to PubMed and punch in a couple keywords, see what is out there. Sometimes I'll look if I know one researcher is deeply into one topic, and I'll see what that person has done, and then maybe follow to I'll see what comes up with, you know, for similar studies, and keep going like that until I get to, you know, until I find something that answers the question that has been asked. Now, once I found those studies, then the trick becomes, now how do I get full copies of those without paying $30, mm-hmm. you know, per study? And that's a whole other area where, you know, I'll be going to the researchers' websites. Usually they're university websites, and a lot of times they'll have PDFs of their own studies up there that aren't yet, you know, available to the general public. So whatever I can do, and then if all those resorts fail, then I'll just then I'll go to Facebook and go to a private group where I know researchers hang out and say, hey, can anybody get me a copy of this study? Mm-hmm. So that's my process. And then putting it together a lot of times comes down to my judgment, decide what's important, what's relevant, what's going to help people, what's not going to help people, what's interesting versus what's useful. And I always remember something that I learned at Men's Health Magazine from Mark Bricklin, who was an editor there who sort of invented, you know, contemporary service journalism, which is he said that information's only as good as its converse. So if you find information that's interesting, but there's no converse to it, nobody is arguing the opposite, then what you just have is interesting. It's not it's not something that is going to really, you know, help people, get a lot of attention. What you want is information that puts a twist on something, and that there are people out there who say, well, that can't possibly be true. That's the sort of information that you want. That's the kind of information that gets people's attention and can actually help people, because most people out there sort of understand the basics, at least. If I want to get stronger, I have to lift heavier weight. If I, you know, if I want to lose weight, I have to do some combination of eating less, moving more. Question then becomes, how do I do it? And most people have a lot of conflicting ideas about how to do all those things. So if you can find something that helps clarify that and at the same time helps convince them that something they were doing before isn't working as well, then you've, you know, that's sort of like, at that point, you've done your job.
Yeah, and with everything that I said before, I really do hope that John Fass starts back up the Strength of Evidence podcast. That was really good, the couple episodes that he did. So hopefully he can get that stuff back on track, because that's how I like to digest stuff. I like to – I have about an hour and a half of driving to work. So getting that information via audio is always a little bit more effective. But little under the gun right now, but for as we wrap up the episode, I'll love to kind of ask you, this is the Lou Schuler State of the Union that we've done for going on 8 years now. Where do you see all this stuff going? Because you've talked about, in the last hour, you've talked about all these things that have changed the way that people digest information, you know, the way that people debate about this information. Where do you see the industry going? What trends are you predicting, or what are you seeing?
I'll tell you. What I think at this minute is that we still don't know some of the really fundamental questions. Yeah. Like, how did people gain so much? How did all of a sudden people start gaining all this weight? Mm-hmm. Because the food they were eating, we can say, well, you know, corn, you know, food got cheaper, and so it was more available, and we can talk about all these things that happened, and we can prove they happened, but I still don't think we understand how people got so hungry that they ate all this food, because no matter how cheap a Big Mac is, I'm not going to eat the fucking thing. I can afford it. I'm not going to eat it. So why did so many people eat these things and eat so many of these things and eat all these foods that just made them hungrier for other foods? What convinced them to do this? What biological mechanism kicked in that made people perpetually overeat, that got people up to the size they are? What mechanisms keep them at these sizes that are bigger than, you know, that were bigger than previous generations? And why did all this level off? Because we had this obesity epidemic, that's actually a crappy term, but we had this weight gain phenomenon that went up in this diagonal line from like the mid to late 70s, early 80s, all the way up. And then it just stops at like 2002, and then it just has leveled off for like 10, 12 years. So what happened? How did that happen? I still don't think we understand exactly. We understand what people ate and how much of it they ate and how little they exercised. We've got all that data, but we still don't understand what gave them the desire to do that, to eat all that food. Because junk, you know, crappy food's been with us forever. You know, we've gone through periods where people had more than enough to eat, and some of them did get fat, but most of them didn't. So why did so many people gain so much weight during that one period? And then why did it level off? And because it leveled off, does that mean it's going to start going down? And if that happens, then we're going to have to admit that all the shit we've been arguing about, we were wrong, that we did not understand whatever basic mechanism was underneath that. Now, it could have been an industrial pollutant. It could have been something having to do with plastics and the way that foods are packaged. It could certainly have something to do with something getting into the water or the air or the ground that triggered this, and that somehow a human equilibrium mechanism kicked in to make this all level off, so that people got to this size but then didn't get any bigger, that it just stopped going upwards. So society-wide, that's, I think, where I would say we are now. And what I think is going to be the most fascinating question to answer is, why did that happen? Why did it happen then? Why did it stop happening? And I would not be surprised if a generation from now, people are actually a little bit smaller or at least more stable. We may at some point figure out what it was. It was probably a combination of things. Nothing's ever one thing. But where we've been, we've spent so many words and hours and years hectoring people, saying, you know, you did everything wrong, and that's why you got fat. Well, what, you know, it's like, okay, so, but what triggered them doing this wrong, these wrong things? What made them so hungry for this crappy food when everybody knew it was crappy food? So why did people keep eating it? And then you can be as pejorative as you want toward those people, but the fact of the matter is that people like them didn't achieve these sizes in previous generations. So what was it that happened there? Why did it stop happening? And if it starts to decline, then we have to ask, okay, then what was it? Because no higher percentage of people are working out seriously than ever before. And by seriously, I mean working out hard enough at high enough intensity and with enough volume to trigger an actual biological effect in their muscle mass and their metabolism, that sort of thing. Lots of people are doing lots of low intensity exercise, but that's probably not having any appreciable effect on the society-wide trends when it comes to weight. So if it's been the question I wonder about is if it's been something that was outside of our control the whole time, meaning that there were certain pollutants out there, that it may have been, fertilizers, it may have been something that was in the air, it may have been the plastics. If it was something like that that created this incredible skew of human weight trends, then what does that say about us as fitness professionals? We help some of those people lose weight. Most of them are still. We didn't help them that much, then maybe all this screaming that we've been doing, especially the screaming we've been doing at each other, maybe it's all been like totally pointless and we've all been looking at the wrong thing and we haven't actually helped many people. That would be something really sad to admit. I don't think that is the final answer, but I definitely think that there's a lot out there that we don't know yet. And I, for one, am really interested in knowing and, you know, hopefully that'll happen, before I'm off drooling in a napkin somewhere.
Yeah, let's hope so. Well, anyways, maybe we will reconnect in 50 years and say, oh yeah, I guess Lou got it right.
Yeah. So on the 30,000th episode of the FitCast. When I'm on, you know, the 300.
It'll be the Neo Fitcast by then.
Yeah, the Neo Fitcast, the cortical Fitcast. We'll just go straight into the brain.
Yeah, that'd be great. But yeah, I mean, that's super interesting.
And it's, yeah, what a way to end, huh?
Yeah, it's got me kind of thinking for a little bit. I'm just hoping that we're not the best outlook I could have is that we're not all the way towards the. What was that Pixar cartoon with the little robot dude?
WALL-E?
Oh, yeah. As long as it's not like WALL-E where we're sitting on a spaceship, like being rolled around in recliners. Actually, that doesn't sound that bad, but.
I'll tell you though, 5 years ago, people thought that was where everything was going. Or 10 years ago, they thought we're going to get to a point where everybody is super obese. But that was never, ever going to happen because nobody ever is all one thing. It's like saying, wow, look at guys in the NBA. Someday we're all going to be 7 feet tall, which, of course, is ludicrous. And again, we're looking at outliers and saying that, you know, and using that as an example of something that can be achieved by non-outliers. But it when we think that something is going one direction, then everybody will eventually get there. We're always wrong about that, you know, when we go to extremes. But the fact that we were thinking that just a few years ago really says something about how little we know. And we don't know that much more now, except that we're pretty sure that we're not going to get to that point where everybody's, you know, that like super, super obese. We're also never going to get to the point where all of us are CrossFit Games competitors. You know, we're never going to get to the point where all of us are outliers because by definition, that's not possible. So I think if, you know, my big wish for the industry, one is that we stop focusing on outliers and pretend that we can make people outliers if that's not something that is in the cards for them. And second, that we sort of stop focusing on each other and get back to focusing on the end users of our products, you know, which are the people we're trying to help. Either we're helping them or we're not. And where we can help people, no matter what the cause of somebody gaining a lot of weight was, we certainly understand the mechanisms of putting that in reverse. They don't work for everybody, but we know that we can get people to stop eating that crap food. We can get people up and moving more than they're moving now. So we know we can help these people. The details are always interesting, and there's always so many different ways to do it. And there's different people who are going to react to different, not just different modalities, but different pitches, different approaches. You know, they may like the guy who yells at them. They may not like the guy who yells at them. You know, they may like somebody who's their best buddy. Whatever it is, there's a lot of people out there who need what we have. There's a lot of us out there who can help those people out there, but you know, they're I think we have to stop blaming them for a condition that we don't understand. We have to stop comparing them to outliers, who again, they can't be, and we have to stop focusing on each other and focus on them. What can we do to help that person who's not getting results? What can we do to make that person's life better? As opposed to what can we do to prove that guy over there wrong?
I think that's a perfect place to end. Thoughts for people to digest. All right, well, that is going to wrap it up for this episode. We're going to be having 299 with Nick Winkelman up next. And then if you're hearing this right now and you want to start getting questions in for the man that hijacked episode 300, called it for himself, Dan John. He's going to be coming up on 300, so feel free to start getting in questions for that. And then right after that is going to be Molly Galbraith is going to be coming up some more with Molly. But Lou, thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk about this, and lots of stuff to think about.
Well, that's what happens when you talk for like 8 hours, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
How long it's been, yeah. So, and by the way, I want to say not only thanks to you, Kevin, for doing this through, you know, we're up to 298 episodes. So good on you for doing that. But thank you to everybody who's still listening to this.
Yeah.
Because it's possible that the most interesting stuff was at the very end. So I appreciate everybody who's paying attention to this.
No, totally. It's always cool stuff to listen to. And don't forget to check out all Lou's great stuff that he's got going on. Amazon is always the best place to buy stuff. It's just one click away from arriving at your household. So, yeah, Lou, thanks again. We'll definitely be talking to you down the road.
Okay, thanks. Can't wait for episode 400.
Totally.